Donald was wounded in the battle and yielded to Sir Elwood Hart. He was ransomed afterward and pledged his fealty to King Joffrey, as did many other captives.
So he did, said Jamie. Even so, Renly, Stannis, Joffrey, Tommen. How did he come to omit Balon Greyjoy and Robb Stark? He might have been the first knight in the realm to swear fealty to all six kings. Sir Balon's unease was plain.
Donald erred, but he is Tommen's man now. You have my word.
It is not Sir Donald the Constant who concerns me. It's you. Jamie leaned forward. What will you do if brave Sir Donald gives his sword to yet another usurper, and one day comes storming into the throne room? And there you stand all in white, between your king and your blood. What will you do?
My lord, that will never happen.
It happened to me, Jamie said. Swan wiped his brow with the sleeve of his white tunic. You have no answer?
My lord, Sir Balon drew himself up, on my sword, on my honour, on my father's name, I swear I shall not do as you did.
Jamie laughed.
Good. Return to your duties, and tell Sir Donald to add a weather vane to his shield.
And then he was alone with a knight of flowers. Slim as a sword, lithe and fit, Sir Loras Tyrell wore a snowy linen tunic and white wool breeches, with a gold belt around his waist and a gold rose clasping his fine silk cloak. His hair was a soft brown tumble, and his eyes were brown as well, and bright with insolence. He thinks this is a tourney, and his tilt has just been called.
17, and a knight of the King's Guard, said Jamie. You must be proud.
Prince Aemon, the Dragon Knight, was 17 when he was named. Did you know that?
Yes, my lord.
And did you know that I was 15?
That as well, my lord.
He smiled. Jamie hated that smile.
I was better than you, Sir Loras. I was bigger, I was stronger, and I was quicker.
And now you're older, the boy said. My lord. He had to laugh.
This is too absurd. Tyrion would mock me unmercifully if he could hear me now, comparing cocks with this green boy.
Older and wiser, sir. You should learn from me.
As you learn from Sir Boros and Sir Meron. That arrow hit too close to the mark.
I learn from the White Bull and Barristan the Bold, Jamie snapped. I learn from Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning, who could have slain all five of you with his left hand while he was taking a piss with his right. I learn from Prince Lewin of Dorne, and Sir Oswald Went, and Sir Jonathor Darry. Good men, everyone.
Dead men, everyone.
He's me, Jamie realized suddenly. I'm speaking to myself, as I was, all cocksure arrogance and empty chivalry. This is what it does to you. To be too good, too young.
As in a sword fight, sometimes it is best to try a different stroke. It said you fought magnificently in the battle, almost as well as Lord Renly's ghost beside you. A sworn brother has no secrets from his Lord Commander. Tell me, sir, who was wearing Renly's armour? For a moment, Loras Tyrell looked as though he might refuse, but in the end he remembered his vows.
My brother, he said sullenly. Renly was taller than me and broader in the chest. His armour was too loose on me, but it suited Garland well.
Was the masquerade your notion or his?
Lord Littlefinger suggested it. He said it would frighten Stannis's ignorant men-at-arms.
And so it did.
And some knights and lordlings, too.
Well, you gave the singers something to make rhymes about. I suppose that's not to be despised.
What did you do with Renly?
I buried him with mine own hands, in a place he showed me once when I was a squire at Storm's End. No one shall ever find him there to disturb his rest.
He looked at Jamie defiantly. I will defend King Tommen with all my strength, I swear it. I will give my life for his if need be. But I will never betray Renly, by word or deed. He was the king that should have been. He was the best of them.
The best dressed, perhaps, Jamie thought, but for once he did not say it.
The arrogance had gone out of Sir Loras the moment he began to speak of Renly.
He answered truly, he is proud and reckless, and full of piss. But he is not false, not yet.
As you say, one more thing, and you may return to your duties.
Yes, my lord.
I still have Brian of Tarth in a tower cell.
The boy's mouth hardened. A black cell would be better.
You're certain that's what she deserves?
She deserves death. I told Renly that a woman had no place in the Rainbow Guard. She won the melee with a trick.
I seem to recall another knight who was fond of tricks. He once rode a mare in heat against a foe mounted on a bad-tempered stallion. What sort of trickery did Brian use?
Sir Loras flushed. She leapt. Oh, it makes no matter. She won, I grant her that. His Grace put a rainbow cloak about her shoulders, and she killed him. Or let him die.
A large difference there.
The difference between my crime and the shame of Boris Blunt. She had sworn to protect him. Sir Eamon Kai, Sir Robar Royce, Sir Parman Crane, they'd sworn as well. How could anyone have hurt him, with her inside his tent and the others just outside? Unless they were part of it.
There were five of you at the wedding feast, Jamie pointed out.
How could Joffrey die, unless you were part of it?
Sir Loras drew himself up stiffly.
There was nothing we could have done.
The wench says the same. She grieves for Renly, as you do. I promise you, I never grieve for Ares. Brian's ugly and pighead stubborn, but she lacks the wits to be a liar, and she is loyal past the point of sense. She swore an oath to bring me to King's Landing, and here I sit. This hand I lost. Well, that was my doing as much as hers. Considering all she did to protect me, I have no doubt that she would have fought for Renly had there been a foe to fight. But a shadow?
Jamie shook his head.
Draw your sword, Sir Loras. Show me how you'd fight a shadow. I should like to see that.
Sir Loras made no move to rise. She fled, he said. She and Catelyn Stark. They left him in his blood and ran. Why would they, if it was not their work?
He stared at the table.
Renly gave me the van. Otherwise it would have been me helping him don his armour. He often entrusted that task to me. We had prayed together that night. I left him with her. Sir Parman and Sir Eamon were guarding the tent, and Sir Robar Royce was there as well. Sir Eamon swore Brian had...
Although... Yes? Jamie prompted, sensing a doubt.
The gorget was cut through, one clean stroke, through a steel gorget. Renly's armour was the best, the finest steel. How could she do that? I tried myself, and it was not possible. She's freakish strong for a woman, but even the mountain would have needed a heavy axe. And why armour him, and then cut his throat?
He gave Jamie a confused look.
If not her, though, how could it be a shadow?
Ask her. Jamie came to a decision. Go to a cell. Ask your questions and hear her answers. If you are still convinced that she murdered Lord Renly, I will see that she answers for it. The choice will be yours. Accuse her or release her. All I ask is that you judge her fairly on your honour as a knight.
Sir Loras stood. I shall, on my honour.
We are done, then. The younger man started for the door, but there he turned back.
Renly thought she was absurd.
a woman dressed in man's mail, pretending to be a knight. If he'd ever seen her in pink satin and Moorish lace, he would not have complained. I asked him why he kept it close, if he thought her so grotesque. He said that all his other knights wanted things of him, castles or honours or riches, but all that Brian wanted was to die for him. When I saw him all bloody, with her fled and the three of them unharmed, if she's innocent, then Robar and Eamon. He could not seem to say the words. Jamie had not stopped to consider that aspect of it. I would have done the same, sir. The lie came easy, but Sir Loras seemed grateful for it. When he was gone, the Lord Commander sat alone in the White Room, wondering. The Knight of Flowers had been so mad with grief for Renly that he had cut down two of his own sworn brothers, but it had never occurred to Jamie to do the same with the five who had failed Joffrey. He was my son, my secret son. What am I if I do not lift the hand I have left to avenge mine own blood and seed? He ought to kill Sir Boris at least, just to be rid of him. He looked at his stump and grimaced. I must do something about that. If the late Sir Jaslyn Bywater could wear an iron hand, he should have a gold one. Cersei might like that, a golden hand to stroke her golden hair and hold her hard against me. His hand could wait, though. There were other things to tend to first. There were other debts to pay. Sansa. In the tower room, at the heart of Maegor's Holdfast, Sansa gave herself to the darkness. She drew the curtains around her bed, slept, woke weeping, and slept again. When she could not sleep, she lay under the blankets, shivering with grief. Servants came and went, bringing meals, but the sight of food was more than she could bear. The dishes piled up on the table beneath her window, untouched and spoiling, until the servants took them away again. Sometimes her sleep was leaden and dreamless, and she woke from it more tired than when she had closed her eyes. Yet those were the best times, for when she dreamed of father. Waking or sleeping, she saw him, saw the gold cloaks fling him down, saw Sir Ilion striding forward, unsheathing ice from the scabbard on his back, saw the moment when she had wanted to look away. She had wanted to. Her legs had gone out from under her, and she had fallen to her knees. Yet somehow she could not turn her head, and all the people were screaming and shouting, and her prince had smiled at her. He'd smiled, and she'd felt safe, but only for a heartbeat, until he said those words, and her father's legs. That was what she remembered, his legs, the way they jerked when Sir Ilion, when the sword. Perhaps I will die too, she told herself, and the thought did not seem so terrible to her. If she flung herself from the window, she could put an end to her suffering, and in the years to come, the singers would write songs of her grief. Her body would lie on the stones below, broken and innocent, shaming all those who had betrayed her. Sansa went so far as to cross the bedchamber and throw open the shutters. But then her courage left her, and she ran back to her bed, sobbing. The serving girls tried to talk to her when they brought her meals, but she never answered them. Once Grand Maester Pycelle came, with a box of flasks and bottles, to ask if she was ill. He felt her brow, made her undress, and touched her all over while her bedmaid held her down. When he left, he gave her a potion of honey water and herbs and told her to drink a swallow every night. She drank it all right then and went back to sleep. She dreamt of footsteps on the tower stair, an ominous scraping of leather on stone as a man climbs slowly toward her bedchamber, step by step. All she could do was huddle behind the door and listen, trembling as he came closer and closer. It was Sir Ilyen Payne, she knew, coming for her, with ice in his hand, coming to take her head. There was no place to run, no place to hide, no way to bar the door. Finally, the footsteps stopped, and she knew he was just outside, standing there, silent, with his dead eyes and his long, pucked face. That was when she realized she was naked. She crouched down, trying to cover herself with her hands, as the door began to swing open, creaking, the point of the great sword poking through. She woke, murmuring, "Please, please, I'll be good, I'll be good, please don't." But there was no one to hear. When they finally came for her in truth, Sansa never heard their footsteps. It was Joffrey who opened her door. Not Sir Ilyen, but the boy who had been her prince. She was in bed, curled up tight, her curtains drawn, and she could not have said if it was noon or midnight. The first thing she heard was the slam of the door. Then her bed hangings were yanked back, and she threw up a hand against the sudden light and saw them standing over her. "You will attend me in court this afternoon," Joffrey said. "See that you bathe and dress as befits my betrothed." Sandor Clegane stood at his shoulder in a plain brown doublet and green mantle, his burned face hideous in the morning light. Behind them were two knights of the King's Guard in long white satin cloaks. Sansa drew her blanket up to her chin to cover herself. "No," she whimpered. "Please, leave me be. If you won't rise and dress yourself, my hound will do it for you," Joffrey said. "I beg of you, my prince, I'm king now. Dog, get her out of bed." Sandor Clegane scooped her up around the waist and lifted her off the feather bed as she struggled feebly. Her blanket fell to the floor. Underneath, she had only a thin bedgown to cover her nakedness. "Do as you bid, child," Clegane said. "Dress." He pushed her toward her wardrobe, almost gently. Sansa backed away from them. "I did as the queen asked. I wrote the letters. I wrote what she told me. You promised you'd be merciful. Please let me go home. I won't do any treason. I'll be good, I swear it. I don't have traitor's blood. I don't. I only want to go home." Remembering her courtesies, she lowered her head. "As it please you," she finished weakly. "It does not please me," Joffrey said. "Mother says I'm still to marry you, so you'll stay here and you'll obey." "I don't want to marry you," Sansa wailed. "You chopped off my father's head. He was a traitor. I never promised to spare him, only that I'd be merciful, and I was. If he hadn't been your father, I would have had him torn or flayed. But I gave him a clean death." Sansa stared at him, seeing him for the first time. He was wearing a padded crimson doublet, patterned with lions, and a cloth of gold cape with a high collar that framed his face. She wondered how she could ever have thought him handsome. His lips were as soft and red as the worms you found after a rain, and his eyes were vain and cruel. "I hate you," she whispered. King Joffrey's face hardened. "My mother tells me that it isn't fitting that a king should strike his wife. Sir Meryn." The knight was on her before she could think, yanking back her hand as she tried to shield her face, and backhanding her across the ear with a gloved fist. Sansa did not remember falling, yet the next she knew, she was sprawled on one knee amongst the rushes. Her head was ringing. Sir Meryn Trant stood over her, with blood on the knuckles of his white silk glove. "Will you obey now, or shall I have him chastise you again?" Sansa's ear felt numb. She touched it, and her fingertips came away wet and red.
As you command, my lord.
Your grace, Geoffrey corrected her. I shall look for you in court. He turned and left. Sir Meryn and Sir Ares followed him out, but Sandor Clegane lingered long enough to yank her roughly to her feet.
Save yourself some pain, girl, and give him what he wants.
What does he want? Please tell me.
He wants you to smile, and smell sweet, and be his lady love,
the hound rasped.
He wants to hear you recite all your pretty little words the way the scepter taught you. He wants you to love him, and fear him.
After he was gone, Sansa sank back onto the rushes, staring at the wall until two of her bedmaids crept timidly into the chamber. "I will need hot water for my bath, please," she told them, "and perfume, and some powder to hide this bruise." The right side of her face was swollen and beginning to ache, but she knew Geoffrey would want her to be beautiful. The hot water made her think of Winterfell, and she took strength from that. She had not washed since the day her father died, and she was startled at how filthy the water became. Her maids sluiced the blood off her face, scrubbed the dirt from her back, washed her hair, and brushed it out, until it sprang back in thick auburn curls. Sansa did not speak to them, except to give them commands. They were Lannister servants, not her own, and she did not trust them. When the time came to dress, she chose the green silk gown that she had worn to the tourney. She recalled how gallant Joff had been to her that night at the feast. Perhaps it would make him remember as well, and treat her more gently. She drank a glass of buttermilk and nibbled at some sweet biscuits as she waited to settle her stomach. It was midday when Sir Meryn returned. He had donned his white armour, a shirt of enamel scales chased with gold, a tall helm with a golden sunburst crest, greaves and gorget and gauntlet and boots of gleaming plate, a heavy wool cloak clasped with a golden lion. His visor had been removed from his helm, to better show his dour face, pouchy bags under his eyes, a wide, sour mouth, rusty hair spotted with grey.
"My lady," he said, bowing, as if he had not beaten her bloody only 3 hours past, "his grace has instructed me to escort you to the throne room."
"Did he instruct you to hit me if I refused to come?"
"Are you refusing to come, my lady?"
The look he gave her was without expression. He did not so much as glance at the bruise he had left her. He did not hate her, Sansa realized. Neither did he love her. He felt nothing for her at all. She was only a thing to him. "No," she said, rising. She wanted to rage, to hurt him as it hurt her, to warn him that when she was queen, she would have him exiled if he ever dared strike her again. But she remembered what the hound had told her, so all she said was, "I shall do whatever His Grace commands."
"As I do," he replied.
"Yes, but you are no true knight, Sir Meryn." Sandor Clegane would have laughed at that, Sansa knew. Other men might have cursed her, warned her to keep silent, even beg for her forgiveness. Sir Meryn Trant did none of these. Sir Meryn Trant simply did not care. The balcony was deserted save for Sansa. She stood with her head bowed, fighting to hold back her tears, while below Joffrey sat on his iron throne and dispensed what it pleased him to call justice. 9 cases out of 10 seemed to bore him. Those he allowed his council to handle, squirming restlessly while Lord Baelish, Grand Maester Pycelle, or Queen Cersei resolved the matter. When he did choose to make a ruling, though, not even his queen mother could sway him. A thief was brought before him, and he had Sir Ilion chop his hand off, right there in court. 2 knights came to him with a dispute about some land, and he decreed that they should duel for it on the morrow.
"To the death,"
he added. A woman fell to her knees to plead for the head of a man executed as a traitor. She had loved him, she said, and she wanted to see him decently buried.
If you loved a traitor, you must be a traitor too, Joffrey said.
Two gold cloaks dragged her off to the dungeons. Frog-faced Lord Slint sat at the end of the council table, wearing a black velvet doublet and a shiny cloth of gold cape, nodding with approval every time the king pronounced a sentence. Sansa stared hard at his ugly face, remembering how he had thrown down her father for Sir Ilion to behead, wishing she could hurt him, wishing that some hero would throw him down and cut off his head. But a voice inside her whispered, "There are no heroes." And she remembered what Lord Petar had said to her here in this very hall. "Life is not a song, sweetling," he told her. "You may learn that one day, to your sorrow." "In life, the monsters win," she told herself. And now it was a hound's voice. She heard a cold rasp, metal on stone.
"Save yourself some pain, girl, and give him what he wants."
The last case was a plump tavern singer, accused of making a song that ridiculed the late King Robert. Joff commanded them to fetch his wood harp and ordered him to perform the song for the court. The singer wept and swore he would never sing that song again, but the king insisted. It was sort of a funny song, all about Robert fighting with a pig. The pig was the boar who'd killed him, Sansa knew, but in some verses it almost sounded as if he were singing about the queen. When the song was done, Joffrey announced that he'd decided to be merciful. The singer could keep either his fingers or his tongue. He would have a day to make his choice. Janus Slint nodded. That was the final business of the afternoon, Sansa saw with relief. But her ordeal was not yet done. When the herald's voice dismissed the court, she fled the balcony, only to find Joffrey waiting for her at the base of the curving stairs. The hound was with him, and Sir Meron as well. The young king examined her critically, top to bottom. "You look much better than you did." "Thank you, Your Grace," Sansa said. Hollow words, but they made him nod and smile.
"Walk with me,"
Joffrey commanded, offering her his arm. She had no choice but to take it. The touch of his hand would have thrilled her once. Now it made her flesh crawl.
"My name day will be here soon," Joffrey said, as they slipped out the rear of the throne room. "There will be a great feast and gifts. What are you going to give me?"
I had not thought, my lord."
"Your Grace," he said sharply, "you truly are a stupid girl, aren't you? My mother says so."
"She does?" After all that had happened, his words should have lost their power to hurt her, yet somehow they had not. The queen had always been so kind to her.
"Oh, yes, she worries about our children, whether they'll be stupid like you. But I told her not to trouble herself."
The king gestured, and Sir Meron opened the door for them. "Thank you, Your Grace," she murmured. "The hound was right," she thought. "I am only a little bird repeating the words they taught me." The sun had fallen below the western wall, and the stones of the Red Keep glowed dark as blood.
"I'll get you with child as soon as you're able," Joffrey said as he escorted her across the practice yard. "If the first one is stupid, I'll chop off your head and find a smarter wife. When do you think you'll be able to have children?"
Sansa could not look at him. He shamed her so. "Septa Mordaine says most high-born girls have their flowering at 12 or 13. Joffrey nodded.
"This way."
He led her into the gatehouse, to the base of the steps that led up to the battlements. Sansa jerked back away from him, trembling. Suddenly she knew where they were going.
"No,"
she said, her voice a frightened gasp.
"Please, no, don't make me. I beg you."
Joffrey pressed his lips together.
"I want to show you what happens to traitors,"
Sansa shook her head wildly.
"I won't. I won't."
"I can have Sir Meryn drag you up," he said. "You won't like that. You'd better do what I say."
Joffrey reached for her, and Sansa cringed away from him, backing into the Hound.
"Do it, girl,"
Sandor Clegane told her, pushing her back toward the king. His mouth twitched on the burned side of his face, and Sansa could almost hear the rest of it.
"He'll have you up there, no matter what, so give him what he wants."
She forced herself to take King Joffrey's hand. The climb was something out of a nightmare. Every step was a struggle, as if she were pulling her feet out of ankle-deep mud. And there were more steps than she would have believed, 1,000 steps, and horror waiting on the ramparts. From the high battlements of the gatehouse, the whole world spread out below them. Sansa could see the great Sept of Baelor on Visenya's Hill, where her father had died. At the other end of the Street of the Sisters stood the fire-blackened ruins of the Dragon Pit. To the west, the swollen red sun was half hidden behind the Gate of the Gods. The Salt Sea was at her back, and to the south was the fish market and the docks, and the swirling torrent of the Blackwater Rush. And to the north, she turned that way, and saw only the city, streets and alleys and hills and bottoms and more streets and more alleys and the stone of distant walls. Yet she knew that beyond them was open country, farms and fields and forests, and beyond that, north and north and north again, stood Winterfell.
"What are you looking at?" Joffrey said. "This is what I wanted you to see, right here."
A thick stone parapet protected the outer ridge of the rampart, reaching as high as Sansa's chin, with crenellations cut into it every 5 feet for archers. The heads were mounted between the crenels, along the top of the wall, impaled on iron spikes, so they faced out over the city. Sansa had noted them the moment she stepped out onto the wall walk, but the river and the bustling streets and the setting sun were ever so much prettier. "He can make me look at the heads," she told herself, "but he can't make me see them."
"This one is your father," he said. "This one here. Dog, turn it around so she can see him."
Sandor Clegane took the head by the hair and turned it. The severed head had been dipped in tar to preserve it longer. Sansa looked at it calmly, not seeing it at all. It did not really look like Lord Eddard, she thought. It did not even look real. "How long do I have to look?" Joffrey seemed disappointed.
"Do you want to see the rest?"
There was a long row of them. "If it please, Your Grace." Joffrey marched her down the wall walk, past 12 more heads and 2 empty spikes.
"I'm saving those for my Uncle Stannis and my Uncle Renly," he explained.
The other heads had been dead and mounted much longer than her father. Despite the tar, most were long past being recognizable. The king pointed to one and said,
"That's your scepter there."
But Sansa could not even have told that it was a woman. The jaw had rotted off her face, and birds had eaten one ear and most of a cheek. Sansa had wondered what had happened to Septa Mordaine, although she supposed she had known all along. "Why did you kill her?" she asked. "She was godsworn."
"She was a traitor."
Joffrey looked pouty. Somehow, she was upsetting him.
"You haven't said what you mean to give me for my name day. Maybe I should give you something instead. Would you like that?"
"If it please you, my lord," Sansa said. When he smiled, she knew he was mocking her.
"Your brother is a traitor too, you know."
He turned Septa Mordaine's head back around.
"I remember your brother from Winterfell. My dog called him the Lord of the Wooden Sword. Didn't you, dog?"
"Did I?"
the Hound replied.
"I don't recall."
Joffrey gave a petulant shrug.
"Your brother defeated my Uncle Jaime.
My mother says it was treachery and deceit. She wept when she heard. Women are all weak, even her, though she pretends she isn't. She says we need to stay in King's Landing in case my other uncles attack. But I don't care. After my name day feast, I'm going to raise a host and kill your brother myself. That's what I'll give you, Lady Sansa, your brother's head.
A kind of madness took over her then, and she heard herself say, Maybe my brother will give me your head. Joffrey scowled.
You must never mock me like that. A true wife does not mock her lord. Sir Meryn, teach her.
This time the knight grasped her beneath the jaw and held her head still as he struck her. He hit her twice, left to right and harder right to left. Her lip split and blood ran down her chin to mingle with the salt of her tears.
You shouldn't be crying all the time, Joffrey told her. You're more pretty when you smile and laugh.
Sansa made herself smile, afraid that he would have Sir Meryn hit her again if she did not. But it was no good. The king still shook his head.
Wipe off the blood, you're all messy.
The outer parapet came up to her chin, but along the inner edge of the walk was nothing. Nothing but a long plunge to the bailey 70 or 80 feet below. All it would take was a shove, she told herself. He was standing right there, smirking at her with those fat worm lips.
You could do it, she told herself. You could do it right now. It wouldn't even matter if she went over with him. It wouldn't matter at all.
Here, girl. Sandor Clegane knelt before her, between her and Joffrey. With a delicacy surprising in such a big man, he dabbed at the blood welling from her broken lip. The moment was gone. Sansa lowered her eyes. Thank you, she said when he was done. She was a good girl, and always remembered her courtesies.
The Kingbreaker. A pale shadow and a dark. The two conspirators came together in the quiet of the armory on the Great Pyramid's second level, amongst racks of spears, sheaves of quarrels, and walls hung with trophies from forgotten battles. Tonight, said Skarhaz Mokandak, the brass face of a bloodbat peered out from beneath the hood of his patchwork cloak.
All my men will be in place. The word is Grolio.
Grolio? That is fitting, I suppose. Yes, what was done to him? You were at court.
One guardsman amongst 40, all waiting for the emptied tabard on the throne, to speak the command so we might cut down Bloodbeard and the rest. Do you think the Yunkai would ever have dared present Daenerys with the head of her hostage?
No, thought Selmy. His Dar seemed distraught.
Sham, his own kin of Lorik were returned unarmed. You saw. The Yunkai played as a mummer's farce, with noble His Dar as chief mummer. The issue was never Yerkaz Zoyunsek. The other slavers would gladly have trampled that old fool themselves. This was to give His Dar a pretext to kill the dragons.
Sir Barristan chewed on that. Would he dare?
He dared to kill his queen. Why not her pets? If we do not act, His Dar will hesitate for a time to give proof of his reluctance and allow the wise masters the chance to rid him of the Stormcrow and the Bloodrider. Then he will act. They want the dragons dead before the Volantine fleet arrives.
Aye, they would. It all fit. That did not mean Barristan Selmy liked it any better.
That will not happen.
His queen was the mother of dragons. He would not allow her children to come to harm. The hour of the wolf, the blackest part of night, when all the world's asleep. He had first heard those words from Tywin Lannister, outside the walls of Duskendale. He gave me a day to bring out Aerys unless I returned with the king by dawn of the following day. He would take the town with steel and fire, he told me. It was the hour of the wolf when I went in, and the hour of the wolf when we emerged. Grey Worm and the Unsullied will close and bar the gates at first light.
Better to attack at first light, Scarhouse said. Burst from the gates and swarm across the siege lines. Smash the Yunkai as they come stumbling from their beds.
No, the two of them had argued this before. There is a peace, signed and sealed by Her Grace the Queen. We will not be the first to break it. Once we have taken Hisdar, we will form a council to rule in his place, and demand that the Yunkai return our hostages and withdraw their armies. Should they refuse, then and only then will we inform them that the peace is broken and go forth to give them battle. Your way is dishonourable.
Your way is stupid, the shavepate said. The hour is ripe. Our freedmen are ready, hungry.
Well, that much was true, Selmy knew. Simon Strikeback of the Free Brothers and Malono Yusdub of the Stalwart Shields were both eager for battle, intent on proving themselves and washing out all the wrongs they had suffered in a tide of Yunkish blood. Only Marcellin of the Mother's Men shared Sir Barristan's doubts. We discussed this. You agreed it would be my way.
Agreed, the shavepate grumbled. But that was before Grolio, the head. The slavers have no honour.
We do, said Sir Barristan. The shavepate muttered something in Gascari, then said,
As you wish, though we will rue your old man's honour before this game is done, I think. What of Hisdar's guards?
His grace keeps two men by him when he sleeps, one on the door of his bedchamber, a second within, in an adjoining alcove. Tonight it will be Kraz and Steelskin.
Kraz, the shavepate grumbled. That I do not like.
It need not come to blood, Sir Barristan told him. I mean to talk to Hisdar. If he understands we do not intend to kill him, he may command his guards to yield.
And if not, Hisdar must not escape us.
He will not escape. Selmy did not fear Kraz, much less Steelskin. They were only pit fighters. Hisdar's fearsome collection of former fighting slaves made indifferent guards at best. Speed and strength and ferocity they had, and some skill at arms as well. But blood games were poor training for protecting kings. In the pits, their foes were announced with horns and drums, and after the battle was done and won, the victors could have their wounds bound up and quaff some milk of the poppy for the pain, knowing that the threat was past and they were free to drink and feast and whore until the next fight. But the battle was never truly done for a knight of the king's guard. Threats came from everywhere and nowhere, at any time of day or night. No trumpets announced the foe. Vassals, servants, friends, brothers, sons, even wives, any of them might have knives concealed beneath their cloaks and murder hidden in their hearts. For every hour of fighting, a Kingsguard knight spent 10,000 hours watching, waiting, standing silent in the shadows. King Hisdar's pit fighters were already growing bored and restive with their new duties, and bored men were lax, slow to react. I shall deal with Kraz, said Sir Barristan. Just make certain I do not need to deal with any brazen beasts as well.
Have no fear. We will have Margaz in chains before he can make mischief. I told you the brazen beasts are mine.
You say you have men amongst the Yunkish men.
Sneaks and spies. Reznak has more.
Reznak cannot be trusted. He smells too sweet and feels too foul. Someone needs to free our hostages. Unless we get our people back, the Yunkai will use them against us. Scar has snorted through the nose holes of his mask.
Easy to speak of rescue, harder to do. Let the slavers threaten.
And if they do more than threaten?
Would you miss them so much, old man? A eunuch, a savage, and a sellsword?
Hero, Jogo, and Dario. Jogo is the Queen's blood rider, blood of her blood. They came out of the Red Waste together. Hero is Grey Worm's second in command. And Dario... She loves Dario. He had seen it in her eyes when she looked at him, heard it in her voice when she spoke of him. Dario is vain and rash, but he is dear to her grace. He must be rescued before his Stormcrows decide to take matters into their own hands. It can be done. I once brought the Queen's father safely out of Duskendale, where he was being held captive by a rebel lord, but...
You can never hope to pass unnoticed amongst the Yunkai. Every man of them knows your face by now.
I could hide my face like you, thought Selmy. But he knew the shave-pate was right. Duskendale had been a lifetime ago. He was too old for such heroics. Then we must needs find some other way, some other rescuer, someone known to the Yunkish men whose presence in their camp might go unnoticed.
Dario calls you Sir Grandfather, Scarhars reminded him. I will not say what he calls me. If you and I were the hostages, would he risk his skin for us?
Not likely, he thought, but he said, he might.
Dario might piss on us if we were burning. Elsewise, do not look to him for help. Let the Stormcrows choose another captain, one who knows his place. If the Queen does not return, the world will be one sellsword short. Who will grieve?
And when she does return?
She will weep and tear her hair and curse the Yunkai, not us. No blood on our hands. You can comfort her, tell her some tale of the old days. She likes those. Poor Dario, her brave captain. She will never forget him, no. But better for all of us. If he is dead, yes. Better for Daenerys, too.
Better for Daenerys and for Westeros. Daenerys Targaryen loved her captain, but that was the girl in her, not the queen. Prince Rhaegar loved his lady Lyanna, and thousands died for it. Daemon Blackfyre loved the first Daenerys and rose in rebellion when denied her. Bittersteel and Bloodraven both loved She-Era Seastar, and the Seven Kingdoms bled. The Prince of Dragonflies loved Jenny of Oldstones so much he cast aside a crown, and Westeros paid the bride price in corpses. All three of the sons of the fifth Aegon had wed for love, in defiance of their father's wishes, and because that unlikely monarch had himself followed his heart when he chose his queen, he allowed his sons to have their way, making bitter enemies where he might have had fast friends. Treason and turmoil followed, as night follows day, ending at Summerhall in sorcery, fire, and grief.
Her love for Dario is poison, a slower poison than the locust, but in the end as deadly. There is still Jogo, Sir Barristan said, him and Hero, both precious to her grace.
We have hostages as well, Scarhaz Shavepate reminded him. If the slavers kill one of ours, we kill one of theirs.
For a moment Sir Barristan did not know whom he meant. Then it came to him. The Queen's cupbearers?
Hostages,
insisted Scarhaz Mokandak.
Grazda and Khazar are the blood of the Green Grace. Mazara is a Merrick. Kesmar is Pal, Azak Gazin. Bakaz is Lorik, Hisdar's own kin. All are sons and daughters of the pyramids. Zak, Quasar, Yulez, Hazkar, Dazak, Yerizan, all children of great masters.
Innocent girls and sweet-faced boys. Sir Barristan had come to know them all during the time they served the Queen. Grazar with his dreams of glory. Shy Mazara, lazy Miklas, vain pretty Kesmia, Khazar with her big soft eyes and angel's voice, Dazar the dancer, and the rest. Children,
children of the Arpi. Only blood can pay for blood. So said the Yunkish man who brought us Grolier's head. He was not wrong.
I will not permit it.
What use are hostages if they may not be touched?
Mayhaps we might offer three of the children for Dario, Hero, and Jogo, Sir Barristan allowed. Her Grace
is not here. It is for you and me to do what must be done. You know that I'm right.
Prince Rhaegar had two children, Sir Barristan told him. Rhaenys was a little girl, Aegon a babe in arms. When Tywin Lannister took King's Landing, his men killed both of them. He served the bloody bodies up in crimson cloaks, a gift for the new king. And what did Robert say when he saw them? Did he smile? Barristan Selmy had been badly wounded on the Trident, so he had been spared the sight of Lord Tarwin's gift. But oft he wondered. If I had seen him smile over the red ruins of Rhaegar's children, no army on this earth could have stopped me from killing him. I will not suffer the murder of children. Accept that, or I'll have no part of this. Scarhaz chuckled.
You are a stubborn old man. Your sweet-faced boys will only grow up to be sons of the Harpy. Kill them now, or kill them then.
You kill men for the wrongs they have done, not the wrongs that they may do some day. The Shavepate took an axe down off the wall, inspected it, and grunted.
So be it. No harm to Isdar or our hostages. Will that content you, Sir Grandfather?
Nothing about this will content me. It will serve. The Hour of the Wolf, remember?
I'm not like to forget, sir.
Though the bat's brass mouth did not move, Sir Barristan could sense the grin beneath the mask.
Long has Kandak waited for this night.
That is what I fear. If King Hizdar was innocent, what they did this day would be treason. But how could he be innocent? Selmy had heard him urging Daenerys to taste the poison locusts, shouting at his men to slay the dragon. If we do not act, Hizdar will kill the dragons and open the gates to the queen's enemies. We have no choice in this. Yet no matter how he turned and twisted this, the old knight could find no honour in it. The rest of that long day raced past as swiftly as a snail. Elsewhere, he knew, King Hizdar was consulting with Resnek Mo Resnek, Margaz Olorek, Galaza Galari, and his other Myrinese advisers, deciding how best to respond to Yunkai's demands. But Barristan Selmy was no longer a part of such councils, nor did he have a king to guard. Instead, he made the rounds of the pyramid from top to bottom to ascertain that the sentries were all at their posts. That took most of the morning. He spent that afternoon with his orphans, even took up sword and shield himself to provide a sterner test for a few of the older lads. Some of them had been training for the fighting pits when Daenerys Targaryen took Meereen and freed them from their chains. Those had had a good acquaintance with sword and spear and battle-axe, even before Sir Barristan got hold of them. A few might well be ready. The boy from the Basilisk Isles, for a start, Tumko Lo. Black as Maester's ink he was, but fast and strong, the best natural swordsman Selmy had seen since Jaime Lannister. Larrick as well, the lash. Sir Barristan did not approve of his fighting style, but there was no doubting his skills. Larrick had years of work ahead of him before he mastered proper knightly weapons, sword and lance and mace, but he was deadly with his whip and trident. The old knight had warned him that the whip would be useless against an armoured foe, until he saw how Larrick used it, snapping it around the legs of his opponents to yank them off their feet. No knight as yet but a fierce fighter. Larrick and Tumko were his best. After them, the Lazarine, the one the other boys called Red Lamb, though as yet that one was all ferocity and no technique. Perhaps the brothers, too, three low-born Gescari
enslaved to pay their father's debts. That made six.
Six out of 27.
Selmayr might have hoped for more, but six was a good beginning. The other boys were younger for the most part, and more familiar with looms and ploughs and chamber pots than swords and shields. But they worked hard and learned quickly. A few years as squires, and he might have six more knights to give his queen. As for those who would never be ready, well, not every boy was meant to be a knight. The realm needs candle makers and innkeepers and armourers as well. That was as true in Meereen as it was in Westeros. As he watched them at their drills, Sir Barristan pondered raising Tomko and Larrick to knighthood then and there, and mayhaps the Red Lamb too. It required a knight to make a knight, and if something should go awry tonight, Dorne might find him dead or in a dungeon. Who would dub his squires then? On the other hand, a young knight's repute derived at least in part from the honour of the man who conferred knighthood on him. It would do his lads no good at all if it was known that they were given their spurs by a traitor, and might well land them in the dungeon next to him. They deserved better, Sir Barristan decided. Better a long life as a squire than a short one as a soiled knight. As the afternoon melted into evening, he bid his charges to lay down their swords and shields and gather round. He spoke to them about what it meant to be a knight. It is chivalry that makes a true knight, not a sword, he said. Without honour, a knight is no more than a common killer. It is better to die with honour than to live without it. The boys looked at him strangely, he thought, but one day they would understand. Afterward, back at the apex of the pyramid, Sir Barristan found Missandei amongst piles of scrolls and books, reading. "Stay here tonight, child," he told her. "Whatever happens, whatever you see or hear, do not leave the queen's chambers." "This one hears," the girl said. "If she may ask—" "Best not." Sir Barristan stepped out alone onto the terrace gardens. "I am not made for this," he reflected, as he looked out over the sprawling city. The pyramids were waking one by one, lanterns and torches flickering to life as shadows gathered in the streets below. Plots, ploys, whispers, lies— secrets within secrets, and somehow I have become part of them. Perhaps by now he should have grown used to such things. The Red Keep had its secrets, too. Even Rhaegar, the Prince of Dragonstone, had never trusted him as he had trusted Arthur Dayne. Harrenhal was proof of that. The year of the false spring. The memory was still bitter. Old Lord Went had announced the tourney shortly after a visit from his brother, Sir Oswald Went of the King's Guard. With Varys whispering in his ear, King Aerys became convinced that his son was conspiring to depose him, that Went's tourney was but a ploy to give Rhaegar a pretext for meeting with as many great lords as could be brought together. Aerys had not set foot outside the Red Keep since Duskendale. Yet suddenly he announced that he would accompany Prince Rhaegar to Harrenhal, and everything had gone awry from there. If I had been a better knight, if I had unhorsed the prince in that last tilt, as I unhorsed so many others, it would have been for me to choose the queen of love and beauty. Rhaegar had chosen Lyanna Stark of Winterfell. Barristan Selmayr would have made a different choice. Not the queen who was not present, nor Elia of Dorne. Though she was good and gentle, had she been chosen, much war and woe might have been avoided. His choice would have been a young maiden, not long at court, one of Elia's companions. Though compared to Ashara Dayne, the Dornish princess was a kitchen drab. Even after all these years, Sir Barristan could still recall Ashara's smile, the sound of her laughter. He had only to close his eyes to see her, with her long, dark hair tumbling about her shoulders and those haunting purple eyes. Daenerys has the same eyes. Sometimes, when the queen looked at him,
He felt as if he were looking at Ashara's daughter. But Ashara's daughter had been stillborn, and his fair lady had thrown herself from a tower